1866 proved to be quite an eventful year. On April 6th, the Civil Rights Act of 1866 was passed. Despite being vetoed by President Andrew Johnson, the Austro-Prussian War began and ended all within 7 weeks between June and August. On April 16th, a nitroglycerin explosion in a San Francisco Wells Fargo office killed 14 people and shattered the glass in building windows for a half-mile radius. On August 11th, the world's first roller rink opened up in Newport, Rhode Island. And on October 6th, the Reno Gang commits the first train robbery in the United States. Amongst all this excitement, in a small town in the Utah Territory, a child was born named Robert Leroy Parker, who would grow up to adopt the name Butch Cassidy, one of the most notorious, successful, and celebrated outlaws in the Wild West. But who was Butch Cassidy, and what led him to a life of crime that still captivates the hearts and minds of people in the United States and around the world for almost 150 years? Let's find out right now, together.
Hi, I'm Ryan McCarthy, and welcome to The Stolen Goods. This podcast is all about outlaws, bandits, and scourges of the seven seas. Every week, we're going to take a look at a different one of these characters and learn about them. We'll shine the spotlight on some of the most infamous bandits, outlaws, and pirates in history, and even dig deeper to learn about some that maybe you haven't heard of before. I am not a historian, nor do I claim to be an expert on the topic. I'm just a guy who thinks this type of stuff is rad and wants to learn more about it. So you and I are going to go on this journey and learn about this part of history together. And if you are an expert on this topic and you hear something that's inaccurate, shoot me an email and let me know. I'm here to learn. So grab your bow and arrow, six shooter, and bag of blue, and join me as we walk the plank and plunge into the lawless world of banditry and swashbucklery. Is that a word? Together.
Hey gang, welcome to The Stolen Goods. I'm Ryan McCarthy. Thank you so much for taking a little time out of your day to join me. ryan.thestolengoods@gmail.com. If you want to send me an email and say hi, make a correction. www.thestolengoods.buzzsprout.com. Share the website with your friends or just spread the word. You can click on the Facebook page from there, and I'm trying. I will be the first to admit that my social media skills are abysmal at best, but I'm trying. If you're listening to iTunes or Audible, please leave a review if you're enjoying the podcast. And a big shout out goes to Charles, aka the Tall Dude, for his nice review on iTunes. Thank you very much, brother. All right, so we are in episode one of a three-episode series here, and I'm diving into the world of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and there is just too much to cover to try to do it all in a half-hour or even an hour-long episode. There's even too much to do in two episodes, so we are going to break this up into three shows. Because, you know, if you watch the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which is a great movie, when the movie begins, Butch and Sundance, they're already together. Like, it's just business as usual. But they didn't actually meet each other until they were like 30. So the first show is going to be Butch Cassidy before he meets Sundance. Second show is going to be Sundance before he meets Cassidy. And then the third episode, you guessed it, will be the two of them together. And I got to give a shout out to Tom Hatch, whose book, The Last Outlaws, The Lives and Legends of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, was a huge reference for doing my research, along with a litany of different websites that supplemented my research. And I actually listened to that book on Audible. Audible is my jam. I love Audible. So let's dive into this episode. So today we're talking about Robert Leroy Parker, or Bob, or Roy, as he was called by his family. And he would not assume the name Butch Cassidy for like a couple more decades. So let's just hop into the time machine here. Don't worry, I fixed all the bugs from last time, so everything should go pretty smooth. Ah! Get out of here, Stanley! This isn't your personal kitty litter box! Watch your step. All right, here we are. And if you're wondering what we're doing here in Iowa City, Iowa in 1856, well, it turns out that Bob's family were not only immigrants from England, but they were also Mormons as well. After writing the Book of Mormon in 1829 and publishing it in 1830, Joseph Smith moved the Mormon church headquarters to Kirkland, Ohio to avoid religious persecution. His plan was then to build a type of paradise city in Jackson County, Missouri called Zion. And after that, he started an aggressive campaign to go overseas to Europe to spread the gospel of the Book of Mormon. So he had Heber C. Kimball, Isaac Russell, John Snyder, and Joseph Fielding, along with three other saints, hop on a ship called the Garrick on June 13th, 1837, that arrived in Liverpool, England on July 20th. And 2 days later, they were in the town of Preston, where Joseph Fielding had a brother, Reverend James Fielding, who agreed to allow them to speak at his chapel on July 23rd, and then a week later. But after that, he noticed that some of his church members were asking about getting baptized into the Mormon religion. So he was like, all right, that's enough of that, you know. And one of the people that took to the new denomination was Robert Leroy Parker, grandfather and namesake of our outlaw in question. And he ate it up hook, line, and sinker, as did many other people in Europe. The new religious movement spread like crazy throughout Europe, and by 1850, there were as many Latter-day Saints in Europe as there were in America. Anne Hartley, Robert's fiance, wasn't all that bananas about it, but she got baptized, and on May 25th, 1843, those two crazy kids got married. And a year later, in 1844, their first son, Maximilian, aka Maxie, was born, followed by Arthur, Martha Alice, Margaret, Emily, and Ada. Unfortunately, Margaret and Emily died shortly after being born. The same year that Butch Cassidy's father, Maximilian, was born, an angry mob killed Joseph Smith and his brother while they were in jail for inciting a riot and treason after shutting down a newspaper in Illinois after printing an article about them that they didn't like. But not before he told his successor, Brigham Young, his plans to move the church to Utah. Apparently, the wide-open, unsettled West was the future for the Mormons. So Brigham Young called on all Mormons from overseas to head west to help create this new paradise. Robert was a skilled weaver in a textile mill, and he felt that his talents would be extremely useful in building this new society. So in 1856, the Parkers sold everything they had, except for some silverware that apparently Anne couldn't do without, and a few paintings, and they set sail for Boston, Massachusetts. From there, they took a train to the end of the line in Iowa City, Iowa, where upon which they were informed that they would be walking the rest of the 1,300-mile-long trek. Not only that, but they would be pushing and pulling handcarts, which are a type of two-wheel wheelbarrow to carry their belongings across the unforgiving terrain. The church felt that, considering that these were all city slickers from mill towns in England who knew nothing about frontier life, there was no time to teach them how to handle livestock for travel, and that walking would be faster. So they told the migrating Mormons that it would be a test of faith, and they would build character. But it is also worth mentioning that the church had had a bad harvesting year, and they didn't have any money to provide them with wagon trains. But to the Mormons' credit, they rolled up their sleeves and they grabbed their handcarts and they started marching. I would have been like, you know what? Iowa's cool. I like Iowa. The Parker's Handcart Company, the MacArthur Company, made it to Utah pretty much without incident, unless you consider Max's 6-year-old younger brother Arthur getting separated from the party for 5 days and almost getting eaten by wolves in incident. But, I mean, it's the frontier. Things happen. On the other hand, Butch Cassidy's mother, Ann Campbell Gillies, who was also an immigrating Mormon from England, who had not yet met Maximilian, was in a different handcart party, the Martin Company, which was part of the great handcart tragedy of 1856. They had left for Utah too late in the season and were caught up in Wyoming in a huge snowstorm on October 19th, 1856. By the time the rescue party had arrived, 150 of the 576 people in the Martin Handcart Company had died. But fortunately, Anne and her family did survive. You know, just think about that. Think about how close we came to not having Butch Cassidy. Well, on September 26th, 1856, the Parker family finally reached Salt Lake City, followed by the Gillies family on November 30th. And both families made their way down to the town of Beaver. And in 1862, when Max was 18 years old, he met Anne Gillies, and the two immediately fell in love. And on July 12, 1865, Anne's 19th birthday, they got married. And then on April 13, 1866, Robert Leroy Parker, the child who would go on to become one of the most infamous outlaws in the Old West, was born, followed by 12 siblings: Susan, Joseph, Arthur, Mark, Leona, Blanche, Ebenezer, Jean Ann, Daniel, William, Nina, and Lula. Lula was born in 1884 and died in 1980 and was a consultant on the set of the 1969 movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and wrote a book in 1975 called Butch Cassidy, My Brother. When Bob was 13, his father Max moved the family to the Circle Valley, and Max then went in search for work and got a job at the Silver Wreath Mines about 100 miles away. He was able to return home once a week or so, spend time with the family, but for the most part, he stayed in the mining town, leaving Robert in the role of the man of the house and to tend to the chores, which he did very well. Robert was a hard worker who respected his father and adored his mother. He had an affinity for animals and had a way of communicating with the livestock as well as with wild animals like rabbits and squirrels. He was always friendly and played with the children in town. He always had a lightheartedness about him, which helped make friends wherever he went. As time went on, Robert's father, Max, would become distant from the Mormon church and inactive in religious duties in the community, making him what is commonly known as a Jack Mormon. He started smoking tobacco, which was not allowed in the Mormon faith, and avoided church affairs whenever possible. Max had always had a rebellious streak, even at an early age in England, when he ran from his duties at the textile mills. This rebellious behavior seems to have been passed on to his son Bob, who started smoking and neglecting his Mormon duties as well. Soon he started tending to larger animals and became an excellent horse trainer and breaker, and started working at local ranches. While working at Patrick Ryan's ranch, he inadvertently committed his first crime. He needed a new pair of overalls and was too far away from home, so he rode into town to buy a pair, only to find out that the store was closed. Now, this frustrated Bob. He had gone all this way just to find the store closed, but he decided that it would not be a big deal if he just took a pair of overalls and left an IOU. Some say he also took a piece of pie. The next day, when the store owner found the IOU, he was not amused. He pressed charges and Bob was arrested, and the whole thing was sorted out, but not before Bob was humiliated and was left with a bad taste in his mouth for the justice system. Later that year, Bob took a job at Jim Marshall's ranch, where his mother and his sisters were working. Jim Marshall was very impressed with the work ethic and aptitude of Bob's work, and it was here where he met a man named Mike Cassidy, who would change his life forever. Mike Cassidy was working as a cattle driver for Jim Marshall when he rode into town one day. He also just happened to be a cattle rustler. And rustling cattle is a term used for stealing other ranchers' cattle and rebranding them as their own. It had become more and more of a problem ever since the completion of the first transcontinental railroad line from Omaha, Nebraska to Sacramento, California, which brought more people out west and more demand for beef. A cattle rustler would buy a plot of land close to other ranchers and either would register a brand that was similar looking to other brands so they could just brand their mark over the existing brand, or use what is known as a running iron, aka the cowboy's paintbrush, which was a long iron rod with a curved end used to manually create a brand or augment the existing brand on the cow's flank. Then, all you needed to do was forge a bill of sale and pass the cattle off as a legitimate purchase. A running iron was a perfectly legit tool in the right hands, but being caught with a running iron could mean certain death at the hands of vigilantes if you didn't have the trust of the local ranchers. Stray cows that did not have a brand on them, also known as Mavericks, were preferred. Then all you had to do was put your fresh brand on them and no one was the wiser. Bob Parker was a young teenager with an adventurous heart, and he was mesmerized by this Mike Cassidy. He was a cowboy and a drifter. He had a romantic sense of adventure about him that Bob, at 13, was completely amazed by. Bob had never left Mormon country and experienced the excitement of the outside world, and Mike regaled him with stories about danger and vice all the time. Mike also gave Bob a saddle and a six-shooter, which he taught Bob how to master, and he also taught young Bob the ways of rustling cattle. Bob's mother did not care for Mike Cassidy and saw him as a bad influence on her son. But soon Mike Cassidy moved on. The life of a cattle rustler did not lend itself to stability, but not before opening Robert Parker's eyes to what could be. In June 1884, when Bob was 18, he came home, told his mom that he was leaving first thing in the morning, and didn't want him to leave, and asked him to stay to say goodbye to his father, who was going to be home that night, but he couldn't wait. And he said there was nothing here for him, and he didn't like the struggle that he saw his parents go through, and he told her that he was going to go get a job in the mines of Telluride. The next morning, he left bright and early without saying goodbye. And when his father got back that night, Ann told him the news, and he couldn't believe it, and he felt that there had to be a reason why he left so abruptly, and so he went to investigate, and he found that his son had signed a forged bill of sale for two of Mike Cassidy's friends, claiming to be the owner of a couple of stolen horses. It is suspected that the two men, Charlie and Fred, had families and a lot to lose, and by signing the bill of sale, Bob had done them a favor and forced him to get out of town and avoid the heat, and also start an adventure that he desperately wanted to start anyway. So, when Bob Parker got to Telluride, he found a city sitting in the bottom of a box canyon surrounded by the San Juan Mountains in San Miguel County, Colorado. Telluride was originally named Columbia, but due to some confusion with a town in California also called Columbia, it started to be referred to as Telluride due to the large amount of tellurium, which is an ore that is a gold and silver mix found in the mountains in the area. In addition to gold and silver, iron, lead, zinc, and copper were also found in the mountains in the area. Other people say that Telluride got its name from miners having to take a treacherous narrow mountain pass to get to the city and would shout, "To hell you ride!" which sounds like Telluride if you say it quickly. Either way, the city officially changed its name from Columbia to Telluride in 1887. Bob Parker was not disappointed. The city was a rambunctious mining town of saloons and brothels and fine shops, with thousands of people with thick wads of cash just aching to blow it on all of the vices that the town had to offer. It was just what the eager young man who had left his Mormon world in search of adventure could have hoped for. Bob got himself a job loading ore onto pack mules and bringing them down the mountains to the mills. The job paid well, and while he did send money back to his home sometimes, he ended up blowing most of it on the women in the gambling halls and saloons. He was living it up in Telluride. Then, in 1885, he got into a legal dispute with the local rancher over a horse that the rancher claimed Parker had stolen. Parker was the owner of the horse, named Cornish, but was keeping the horse at the rancher's stable. The rancher noticed the way that Parker had broken and trained the horse and saw the horse's potential, and so he asked Parker to sell the horse, and Parker said no. So one day, the rancher filed an arrest warrant for Parker, claiming that the horse was his. All of his friends backed him up, but Parker had friends of his own, and they reached out to Bob's father, who came to Telluride to testify on his son's behalf. When he got to the jail, he found his son sitting in the jail cell reading a magazine with the cell door wide open. After the horse matter was cleared up and Bob was acquitted, he left Telluride and is thought to have spent the next year or two as a ranch hand in Wyoming and Montana. But by 1887, he was back in Telluride, where he met a man named Matt Warner, whose real name was Willard Erastus Christensen, who was another young Mormon who had left his homeland to avoid legal troubles. Matt was a former horse wrestler who had taken up horse racing, who had a prize horse named Betty that nobody seemed to be able to beat. One day, they raced a horse owned by a group of Utes, one of the local Native American tribes. The wager was ownership of the horse. Matt, Bob, and their other partner, Tom McCarty, won the bet and took off with the Utes' horse. The Utes did not take the loss well and took off after them to get the horse back. Bob and the others told them that they had won the horse fair and square and weren't going to give it back. One of the natives raised his rifle at Tom McCarty. Tom responded by drawing his Colt and shooting the Ute dead. This was a shock to Bob. He had not signed up for this. Butch Cassidy would go his whole career without shooting a man in cold blood and only killing a man at the end of his life. It is speculated that at this moment, he questioned what he was doing out here in a world where people got shot and killed over horses and contemplated going home, but he didn't. Afterward, Bob and Matt got a job as cowboys at a local ranch owned by Harry B. Adsit, while Tom went back to his cabin in Cortez. As time went on, Bob and Matt grew tired of the mundane life of a ranch hand and quit, much to Mr. Adsit's disappointment, and went to Tom's cabin to plan their next move. There seemed to only be one way to get the funds they needed with the excitement they wanted, and that was to rob a bank. So on June 24th, 1889, they strolled into San Miguel Bank in Telluride, Colorado, with Tom McCarty waiting outside by the horses, and Bob and Matt handed a bank check to the teller, and when the teller bent over to inspect the check, Matt Warner slammed his head down on the counter, put a gun to his face, and told him to keep quiet while Bob stuffed bags full of money, and they took off on their horses, successfully robbing San Miguel Bank of $21,750, which is worth $700,186.88 today. However, on their way out of town, they made one little mistake. They ran into local rancher Harry Adsit, but instead of stopping to shoot the breeze, which would have maintained a type of inconspicuousness about them, they spurred their horses and took off and spurred suspicion in Mr. Adsit. Matt Warner later wrote in his book that this little mistake would haunt them for the rest of their lives. They gave law enforcement a clue as to who they were and where they were going. They could never go back to being honest ranch hands after that. The cat was out of the bag. They were outlaws. They then rode to a predetermined location where they had a friend who, for a cut of the money, would watch over some fresh horses that they could swap over to in order to stay well away from the posse that would inevitably be on their tail. This horse relay system would become a trademark strategy for Butch Cassidy throughout his entire career. They then rode for an unknown amount of time, avoiding posses in Colorado and Utah, camping at night without fires to avoid detection, riding off of the trails and suffering from money belts packed with stolen money chafing against their raw, sweaty skin to the point where they would flip out from time to time and threaten to throw the money belt away and be done with it. They didn't dare part with the money and put it on their horses because horses could get shot at, they could get spooked and run away, or they could get stolen. They finally made their way to Browns Park, formerly known as Brown's Hole, a popular fur trapping valley named after Baptiste Brown, which was an alias for Jean Baptiste Chelifou, a French-Canadian fur trapper, horse thief, and mercenary for Mexican California during a time of political turmoil after Mexico's independence from Spain in 1821. Brown's Park was a type of no man's land that was a popular hiding ground for outlaws. Law enforcement rarely went into the territory due to the tough terrain, which provided a lot of chances for them to be ambushed. The valley also fell under a jurisdiction dispute since it straddled three different territories at the time, Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming. Bob, Matt, and Tom took refuge at the ranch of a man named Charlie Krause on Diamond Mountain, where Matt Warner had worked as a ranch hand before. Charlie Krause was a native Virginian and had no problem harboring fugitives. They stayed there for about 4 days to regroup, but soon caught wind that there was a posse on their way looking for them. So they headed south to a place called Robber's Roost, a network of rock formations and tunnels fed by a series of natural springs that made for an excellent hiding place for outlaws. It is rumored that Mike Cassidy had brought Bob Parker there when he was a young teenager when they were running cattle for another rustler, a man named Cat Brown. Old timers in the area later claimed that they saw Butch Cassidy there when he was a young man, and it is not known if they stayed there that summer because nobody has ever found their hideout. According to his sister Lula, during the summer of 1889, Bob Parker almost went back home to see his family, but only made it as far as the town of Milford before he changed his mind. Now, whether it was planned or sheer luck, he ran into his brother Dan, and the two spent the day catching up, and Dan let Bob know that the word had reached Circle Valley that he was an outlaw. After parting ways with his brother, Bob decided to change his name and spare his family any more shame. He had already started using the name George Parker to throw the scent off of him. There apparently was already a man named George Parker who was known for getting into trouble with the law, so why not add to this guy's reputation, right? So he then decided to use the last name Cassidy to honor his friend and mentor, Mike Cassidy. Not knowing where to go, Bob, or George Cassidy, headed back to Brown's Park. But instead of going back to Charlie Krause's house, he met and stayed at the Bassett family ranch. The Bassetts were known for making a living by renting board to outlaws looking to lay low. Elizabeth Bassett is the one credited with changing the name of the valley from Brown's Hole to Brown's Park. Herb and Elizabeth Bassett had moved from Little Rock, Arkansas to Brown's Hole in 1878. Herb was a Civil War vet and was suffering from acute asthma, and the doctor suggested that they move to a drier climate. So Herb decided to pack up everything they had, which included a ton of books, which are really heavy. Like, these things aren't paperback. So Herb, his wife Elizabeth, and their two children, Samuel and Josie, start off on their 1,665-mile-long trek to Los Angeles. But since traveling by horse and wagon was no big deal back then, Herb decided to take a real quick detour to Rock Springs, Wyoming to visit his brother. Like, honey, I'm just going to take a real quick pit stop at my brother's house in Rock Springs. It's only going to add 442 miles to our trip. Like, geez. Like, these people were machines back then. But once they got to Wyoming, his brother told him that their uncle had already settled in Brown's Hole and that the climate was just as good as California. As the story goes, they decided to go to Brown's Hole, and when they got to the top of the rise, just before the valley, Elizabeth told Herb to stop the wagon, stood up to survey the land, and declared that hole was an inappropriate word to describe the valley, and from then on, it would be known as Brown's Park. And in 1878, Anne Bassett was born, who would go on to become the valley's most famous citizen. Now, the Bassetts are worthy of an episode all of their own. So back to Cassidy. So in the summer of 1889, George Cassidy, Bob Parker, meets and stays at the Bassett family ranch, where he feels at home. The Bassett Ranch was the center of society in the Browns Park Valley, hosting dinners and horse races, with Elizabeth taking charge of how the ranch should be run. She was caring and hospitable, and all the visitors and outlaws in the valley loved her. Their family reminded Cassidy of his own. He got to enjoy Herb's extensive library and met Josie and Anne Bassett. Now, Josie claims that they were never a thing and that they were just good friends, but 11-year-old Anne Bassett followed Cassidy around like a puppy dog everywhere he went, and he stayed there for the rest of the summer before leaving early one morning and headed to Wyoming. Now, once in Wyoming at Rock Springs, Cassidy allegedly got a job at a butcher shop owned by William Gotchie. Now, according to his sister Lula, this is evidently how he got his nickname Butch. In an interview, Cassidy also claimed that while working at the butcher shop, Matt Warner gave him the nickname Butch as a joke. Now, there's also a theory that Tom McCarty gave him the nickname while making fun of Cassidy for having difficulty operating a rifle, like, "You okay there, Butch?" So the truth about how he got his nickname may never completely be known. But in the fall of 1889, Cassidy left Rock Springs and went to Fremont County, Wyoming, where he got a job at a ranch owned by Eugene Amoretti, close to Du Bois, who also owned a bank in the town of Lander. And it was here that he met a man named Al Hayner, and the two would become good friends and go into business together. They bought some property up in Horse Creek and started a cattle rustling business. Now, according to locals in the area, Horse Creek was not an ideal place to set up a ranch and attracted few settlers, which is probably why they chose the location. And according to Eugene Amoretti's son, Cassidy would deposit large amounts of money into Amoretti's bank. And as you might expect, that bank never got robbed. During the fall and winter of 1889 and 1890, Cassidy became good friends with the Lander community, especially Will and Margaret Simpson, and even spent Christmas dinner at their house, where he was the life of the Christmas party. And according to old-timers, Al Hayner kept to himself, while Cassidy performed stunts and told jokes and had everyone laughing, from young children to hardened cowboys. And according to the Simpson family, he was very helpful around their ranch and did chores and played with the children. And the Simpsons even claimed that during the winter of 1889-1890, Cassidy helped with a flu epidemic where he delivered Margaret Simpson's homemade remedies as far as 25 miles away, and even making a 120-mile round trip to Fort Washakie during a blizzard to get medicine for the Simpsons' youngest child. However, this claim is disputed by historians. But I choose to believe it because why not? He embedded himself in the community and attended functions and went to dances and is rumored to have two girlfriends while in Lander, Dora Lamoureux and Mary Boyd. But Cassidy wouldn't settle down with either of them, most likely because he was living a false identity and would soon have to leave. And then in spring 1890, Cassidy and Hayner sold their herd, closed up the operation in Horse Creek, and left without explanation. Cassidy made his way to Johnson County, Wyoming, where he ended up buying 580 acres of ranch land on Blue Creek, 10 miles northwest of the Hole in the Wall. And the Hole in the Wall was not a hole so much, but a notch in the canyon where you could drive a herd of cattle or horses through if you knew where to look. The area was so remote and devoid of a law enforcement presence and so full of livestock that it was a perfect area for rustling cattle and horses. Cassidy spent the rest of the year creating a horse rustling business that reached from Colorado all the way to the Dakotas. But by December 1890, Johnson County had gained the attention of larger ranch outfits who sent stock detectives to Johnson County to look for rustlers. Catching wind of this, Butch Cassidy quickly sold his ranch and got out of Dodge. He most likely spent the first half of 1891 at his ranch on Horse Creek with his partner Al Hayner. Then, in the summer of 1891, he met back up with his old friends Matt Warner and Tom McCarty and started rustling cattle all the way from Ten Sleep, Wyoming to the west bank of the Powder River. One day, while driving a stolen herd of about 50 cattle, they stopped to give their horses a rest. And while they were stopped, Cassidy looked off into the distance to see about 10 armed henchmen from a large rancher outfit closing in on them fast. Butch shouted a warning to Tom and Matt, and the three of them abandoned their herd and took off. The pursuers got within shooting distance, leveled their rifles, and started shooting. The three horse thieves galloped as fast as they could, with bullets flying by their heads in the middle of a prairie with nothing to hide behind and nowhere to make a stand. Their only hope was to make it to cover wherever that was. So they pushed their horses for all their worth, with 10 heavily armed regulators closing in on them fast. The sound of gunfire and hoofbeats filled the air while they gripped reins attached to straining horses as they pushed as hard as they could across the pasture land, desperate to get away. Finally, at sundown, they made it to a tree line, and the three rustlers split up to lose their pursuers. How they escaped once they made it to the trees is unknown, but one thing is certain, the jig was up. Their days of rustling cattle and horses in the area were over. The local ranch outfits moving into the area were not going to stand for rustlers stealing their cattle and would use whatever means necessary to bring them down. Butch should have taken this as a warning to get out of the game, but he was in too deep, and the idea of going straight just didn't appeal to him. He then returned to his ranch at Horse Creek in Fremont County with his partner Al Hayner and started rustling cattle there. It had become apparent to the town people that even though Butch and Al did not have a large herd of cattle, they always had tons of money to throw around at the local gambling halls and supply depots. The ranchers in the area became suspicious that Butch and Al were not quite on the up and up and started devising a trap to catch them. So, in August 1891, Butch and Al bought two horses from Joseph Billy Nutcher, who was a local horse rustler who had agreed to set up a sting with the local ranchers to catch Cassidy and Hayner. The horses were stolen, and Butch and Al had fallen into a trap. When they found out about this, they took off, leaving everything behind. They got away and laid low in a ranch outside Lincoln, Wyoming, until April 11th, 1892, when a rancher named John Chapman and Sheriff Bob Calvary, with the help of the local law enforcement, raided the ranch that Hayner and Cassidy were hiding on. Hayner was outside and in the wide open with nowhere to run and was taken into custody almost immediately. Cassidy, on the other hand, was in the bunkhouse and heard the commotion. Calvary yelled into the house that he had a warrant for his arrest, and Cassidy was reported to have said, "Well, get to shooting." So the sheriff busted the door and leveled his gun to shoot, but the gun jammed. Cassidy was then tackled before he could do anything to retaliate. They were both arrested on two counts of grand larceny for two horses, one valued at $40 and the other one valued at $50. That is the equivalent of paying $1,280 or $1,600 by today's standards, and anyone in the market for buying a horse today will say that they would kill for those rock-bottom prices. These horses were deliberately sold at these cheap prices to tempt Butch and Al into a trap. They stayed in jail for 2 months until local friends and neighbors raised the money for bail. The case was delayed for a year due to witnesses not being available, and during that time, he was allowed to roam the countryside. There is one story of Butch going down to San Antonio, Texas, before the trial started to visit the brothel Fanny Porter's House of Ill Repute, where he met a girl there that was no more than 16 years old. He felt that she was too young to be there, and when he left, asked her to come with him, which she happily did. Cassidy brought her to Utah and turned her over to the care of a loving Mormon family. It is speculated that this girl was Etta Place, the future girlfriend of the Sundance Kid, a woman that has been shrouded in mystery in the entire Butch and Sundance story. Now, considering how vast the Wild West was and how easy it would have been for Butch to simply just not return to Wyoming to stand trial, it is a credit to his character that he returned to Lander, Wyoming on June 20th, 1883 and stood trial. Butch was defended by a lawyer named Douglas Preston, whose life Butch has saved during a barroom brawl. Preston, in return, offered his legal defense whenever it was needed. Cassidy was acquitted of this crime, but was immediately charged with the theft of a different horse. Another year passed, during which time Cassidy and Hayner had a falling out, and Butch became suspicious that Hayner had worked out a deal. On top of that, when the trial started in June 1894, the prosecutor for the case was his old friend Will Simpson. The prosecution and the defense made their cases, and the verdict was sealed until Monday morning. Over the weekend, a bunch of Cassidy's friends, including Matt Warner, whose hearts were in the right place as misguided as they were, committed a bunch of acts of intimidation towards the prosecution. Al Hayner horsewhipped a witness, and Will Simpson was attacked but was able to get away. This resulted in a bunch of arrests, including Cassidy. That Monday morning, as the courtroom waited with bated breath for the verdict, the jury foreman unsealed the envelope and read the verdict. Al Hayner was found not guilty. Surprise, surprise. George Cassidy, as he was known in the area, was found guilty of horse theft in the amount of $5, and on June 15, 1894, Butch Cassidy, inmate number 187, was sentenced to 2 years of hard labor. Well, with Butch Cassidy snugly tucked away in the Wyoming State Penitentiary for the next 2 years, this is a perfect stopping point for the first episode of this three-part series of the Butch and Sundance Saga. Thank you so much for carving out some time in your busy schedule to learn about Butch Cassidy with me. I truly do appreciate it. And if you are interested in learning more about his early life, I strongly recommend you pick up the book, The Last Outlaws, The Lives and Legends of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, written by Tom Hatch. It chronicles Sundance's life as well, and we are going to be back next week to talk about his life. So in the meantime, ryan.thestolengoods@gmail.com. Send me an email, say hi, make a correction. thestolengoods.buzzsprout.com. Spread the word, tell your friends about it. And we'll be back next Monday morning at midnight with the next installment of this tale. So until then, I hope you have a great week, and I will talk to you later.